Well, hello everybody, this is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine. Welcome to Rattlecast number 69. Thanks so much for joining us. Today's guest is Jim Peterson, a wonderful poet, a wonderful human being. Looking forward to talking to him in just a little bit. But before we begin, I should say that Rattle is a publication of the Rattle Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit working to promote the practice of poetry. And we've been a continuous publication since 1995 and are unaffiliated with any other organization. If you enjoy poetry as much as we do, please click the like button right now. We already have 6 likes, which is really good before I even ask. And click the like button on YouTube. Click the like button on Facebook. I think it's like on Twitter, too. Give us a review if you're watching this later on iTunes. That's always really great. And 5 stars, that's good, too. Whatever you can click really helps spread this stuff around the internet. And we love poetry, so we hope poetry spreads around the internet. So please do us a favor and click the like button right now. And we always like to begin with a warm-up poem as people gather around. And for the warm-up poem today, I thought that we would do a poem by Eugenia Lee, which was winner of the 2013 Neil Postman Award for Metaphor. And we're publishing another poem by Eugenia for the first time since then in our spring issue. So it reminded me of that. And this is Destination Beautiful. And I'll put it on screen now for all to see. And I'm going to try to do it played a different way so the sound's a little better. So let me, hopefully that will work. Here we go. This is Destination Beautiful by Eugenia Lee.
Destination Beautiful. I've come to hunt a time capsule at the west end of Sunset Boulevard, to rummage the beach for remnants of old friends who've abandoned themselves to sprout new families. Suddenly, everyone has cleaved to strangers made of diamonds and cake, capable of waving away whole bruised childhoods, rotten fruits we used to feed this drooling ocean. Years ago, a friend and I hiked the Will Rogers Trail. We caught a dim rainbow at the cliff where he stood and hid his hands in his pockets. We sucked in the Pacific, the traffic. We met an elderly man called Timothy, a retired tour guide who slept in his car with a book of red-letter scripture seat-belted next to him. I hoped I would die on that mountain because I thought that close to God, it would be a hassle to send me to hell. In the memory of that day, I am alone. The friend is there, also alone. He leans from the cliff and scans the city dots for his beautiful girl, his now wife. Wife. The word bends like a soft branch in my mouth. I've learned not to choke on it by lying achingly still. The waves reach and reach for me over the black ocean, the tender white hands of children petting a large, harmless corpse.
And that was Eugenia Lee with Destination Beautiful. I just love, what an amazing poem that is. The words bend like a soft branch in my mouth. I've learned not to choke on it. Wonderful stuff. And let's look up what she's doing lately. This is her website, EugeniaLee.com. You can see it's on the screen there. It is spelled like it's written, EugeniaLeigh is EugeniaLee.com. So check her out. Her most recent book here is Blood, Sparrows, and Sparrows. And check that out, EugeniaLee.com. Now, today's poet, as I mentioned, is Jim Peterson. And Jim Peterson is the author of 6 collections of poetry, 3 chapbooks, numerous plays, and the novel Paper Crown, all by Red Hen Press, I think, and recently made available on Audible. His poetry collection, The Owning Stone, won Red Hen Press's Benjamin Saltman Award in 1999. His newest collection, other than the newest one, is Speech Minus Applause by 53, by Press 53. His poems have appeared widely and all over the place, a lot of great journals, including Poetry, and Rattle, the current issue of Rattle. He has a poem in, for the first time we've ever published him. And his newest book I'll put on screen right now is The Horse Who Bears Me Away. Just a beautiful book. I mean, what a book this is, and what a cover this is, too. I love what Red Hen Press did with this cover. And here he is, Jim Peterson. Hey, Jim, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Do you want to start us out with a poem?
Sure. And before do that, I just want to thank you and Rattle for having me on. This is great fun and a great opportunity. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's definitely my pleasure. I mean, I'd say I'd been a fan of your work for a long time, but I actually hadn't until really recently. But I've looked through all your work, and I just love the way you write and your style and what you have to say. So I appreciate you being on.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. So I'm going to I have to start this book with the prologue poem, because that's the poem that gives me the title of the book. And so I'm going to start there, and it's called The Horse. In the enormity of bone and flesh that splits the night with blood and breath, in the rising brushstroke of pastern, fetlock, cannon bone, and stifle, in the rolling sloop of dock, croup, withers, and pole, I discover my body. In the barrel that takes to the grip of thighs, the flank that accepts the needling heel, in the mane where I bury my hands at last, in the forelock and muzzle of that long face, in the chin groove, jaw, and throat that swallows my words like cracked oats, in the two black eyes that glean the full circle of horizon, in the shell song of each ear, in the heart, the horse who bears me away.
And that's the opening poem, The Horse. Also the title poem, or the title is contained in it, through Jim Peterson's newest book, The Horse Who Bears Me Away, for Red Hen Press. Jim, let's start out just to sort of get set up and sort of frame this. How did you get into poetry? And what has poetry meant to your life? Like, what has your journey been to get to this place where you have a whole bunch of award-winning, wonderful poetry books to share with us?
You know, it's interesting. I was a spacey kid. I was a kind of I had an artist's temperament, but without any ability, without any skills whatsoever. I was not a musician. I certainly couldn't dance or sing. I couldn't paint or draw. I couldn't, stick figures was my highest level. But there was an artist in me looking for something. And I think I started out listening to people like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. And it was songwriters that the words of some of those songs started getting to me. I also write songs. So that's part of, even though I can't play an instrument, I still write songs. I can't help myself. There was just something in me that wanted to be creative, that wanted to do something that wasn't the norm of what was expected of me. Actually, my father was a successful businessman. He wanted me to go into his business very badly. And I disappointed, I broke his heart, and when I told him I was going to major in English, it was like, I didn't think they were going to be able to get him up off the floor. You know, he just, it was like, what are you talking about? And when I told him I wanted to be a poet, well, you can imagine, this was in a small town in South Carolina. So anyway, the sad part of it is that I wasn't a very good poet for a long, long time. And I like to say this because I think it's true. I didn't know I wasn't good. And that helped me because I kept writing. And when I finally realized I wasn't very good, it was too late. I couldn't stop. And I got better. So I guess if there's one message, maybe there's others, but one would certainly be, you will get better if you keep writing.
What was it that that made you realize that you weren't good, as you put it? And what was the sort of hurdle you had to make to become good? Cause I think you're good now. So,
You know, that's very interesting. I had a very famous teacher at the time. I'm an old guy. I'm 72. And my teacher back in college, when I was like a senior, and then in my graduate school, was James Dickey. And he was one of the two or three most prominent poets in America at that time. And he had this huge mind. He had an encyclopedic mind for literature. And he was crazy as a loon, but he was a good tea. I learned a lot from him. He had us, I mean, all the poems I wrote in his classes where I was trying to say something profound were awful. I mean, I thought they were great. I was being this profound. But what he did that helped me through that was he had us do a lot of crazy things like free association, dream writing, things and he made us write fast so that I didn't have time to censor things. And I didn't have time to wonder whether or not what I was saying was good or profound. And I started waking up to this other part of myself that was really the creative part. It wasn't the conscious mind so much as it was something that was coming to me from an unconscious level that kept surprising the hell out of me. You know, whereas the stuff I'd written before didn't surprise me or anybody, even my dog got bored. You know, it was just, there was no surprise there. You could see what was coming from a mile away. But suddenly when I didn't know what was coming, I began to surprise myself with that next thing that came. And that began to open me to writing some better poems.
That's a good segue to the next poem. I had a request for you to read. If you could read the second poem in the collection, which is Breakfast at the Western Cafe. Would you mind reading that?
Not at all. I like reading this poem. When I was 25 years ago or so, 23 years ago, I lived in Montana, and my wife Harriet was a great horse trainer and teacher and competitive rider and all of that. And I lived with her and with horses for 45 years. And anyway, we lived in Billings, and she would go over to Bozeman to teach there. And she had a famous artist who was a student there in her barn. They had a bunch of students that took from her. So I would leave her there and I would go downtown, and I discovered this place called the Western Cafe, which was this hole in the wall, greasy spoon, great, great place to go and eat. The locals went there, and you could hear all these stories and everything. It was just, you know, from the people around me. And that's what this is based on. All of this is actually true, this particular poem. Breakfast at the Western Cafe. Rain has muddied the river, someone says, and spoiled the fishing for today. Each day climbs on the back of the last one, like breath after breath, getting nowhere. The waitress at the Western Cafe, blonde and beautiful and in demand, turns that river of coffee at the end of her hand into cup after cup. Puts down a cinnamon roll big as a boxing glove, smiles over her secret frown, and the long-faced rancher at table number 4 will not look at her. The girl who starts on Monday sits at the counter all day to learn the ropes. For me, this is time without encroachment, burning in my belly like a Mexican omelet. A sign behind the counter says, T-bone, $2.95. With meat, $8.75. An old photo of the Roundup parade from the 20s catches the marching band mid-stride, sunlight flashing on the tubas and trombones. Two guys remember the rumors of fraud, a small boy creeping under the timbers, and the lazy sloshing of fire. High on one wall, the night-crawling skull of a steer presides over this clanking of spoons and forks. Everywhere here, hands know their roles by heart, curling over the edges of news, drifting over food on grills and tables. An old man in a small room adds receipts. Hutterites at a long table behind me, the strong suspended men, the sackcloth, white-capped women, laugh at their inside jokes. Good workers, the waitress whispers, but they'll steal you blind. The cattle brands burned into wooden plaques above our heads roam over thousands of sections on the butts of steers and cows. The waitress goes home where she chants in her children's ears, smile, remember the regulars, keep moving. There's always something needs to be done. Use up every second of your break. Hearts that know their roles by hand welcome exhaustion as a kind of peace. an elk's head, wears sunglasses, a white Stetson and a red bandana. The bucked-off cowboy in an old photo is always flying above that arched back. Glorious black oblivion in the horse's eye.
Thanks so much. And that was a Breakfast at the Western Cafe by Jim Peterson from his newest book, The Horse Who Bears Me Away. And I just, that last line, the glorious black oblivion in the horse's eye, seems like it contains sort of everything to me. And it's also, there's this black eye of the horse on the cover too. And I'm just wondering, like I had my own interpretation and sort of feeling reading that poem, but I wonder, what do you think of as that black oblivion of the horse's eye? Because that seems like, you know, like all the life swirling around that black eye is sort of the thing that gives them meaning or something. I mean, what is that black eye to you?
Well, I want to try to not get too fancy, yeah. But I fear that I'm going to fail. You know, I'm not sure when I wrote the line that I totally understood this. Again, I believe in this. Poets are given lines. You know, if Jim tried to write that line, he has no chance. It's got to come from some place that's less messed up and conditioned and all of that. So that line came. So now, you know, this is years later. You know, I think in a sense, and that's why the horse becomes such a powerful image for me, that the horse is pure, is innocent, mysterious, wild. The horse, I don't care how trained a horse is. If you're not careful around the horse, you're going to be hurt or dead. I mean, seriously, you got to know what you're doing around horses, because they are oblivious in that sense. They don't give a damn about, they don't care or think in the way that humans do. So there's something, I think that oblivion is the oblivion of innocence, of the horse doing what it just does, which is it throws something foreign off of its back, you know? Now it's up to that rider to know how to fall. And that's what the epigraph is for the book. Is that the right word, epigraph? The Mexican proverb, it goes, it is not enough for a man to know how to ride. He must know how to fall. And so if we're going to be around animals like horses or almost any animals, in a sense, we have to know how to fall. In other words, we have to be conscious in that moment. Because we're going to get thrown. If you're going to ride horses, you're going to be thrown. There is no, you can't start riding horses and say, not me, I'll never be thrown. Yeah, good luck. So good horse people, good riders train to fall. Because they want, as soon as they're going off and they know they're gone, they want to be going in a way where they're seeing everything that's happening and they're conscious. So you got to learn how to ride, but you damn well better learn how to fall.
Yeah, and that the reason why that line seems so central to the book is because it you know, it's not just about riding horses, of course, it's about life, you know, and riding, yeah, sort of the wildness, and to me that the black oblivion is sort of the abyss, you know, and the chaos and the unknown, and you know, just the wildness of this life that we're all living through. And so that all these other lives sort of, you know, moving around this horse's eye, who's about, you know, who's in the middle of throwing the rider. And then the horse sort of doesn't even care or know. It's just a horse being a horse, you know. There's just something great about that line. And it comes sort of, it just hits you. I think it's a great, great poem and a great line there. Thanks for sharing that and writing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I should say, if anybody has any questions for Jim Peterson, just leave them in the chat windows. I'm watching Facebook and YouTube, but not any of the other ones where it's streaming live. So if you have any questions, leave them there and I can pass them along. I have a lot I want to talk about, Jim, but let's do a couple more poems. Maybe, I don't know about the next one you had is longer or shorter, but like one or two, depending on the length. What do you think?
I got a couple. Well, the next one I have is called Laid Off. There's a wide range of poems in this book, but the book is actually thematic from my mind. In my mind, it's moving left to right thematically. It's evolving as you get out to the end. So all these first poems are about characters who are in some state of falling. So this one is called Laid Off. Yesterday, I strolled among the cold meats and the small, bland vegetables in their bins and could not find anything I wanted. I admit, I took some pleasure in ramming the metal cart into the long, stuck row of others, make of that what you will, and walked into the street happy with my hunger. I could feel my body retreating into bone, my skin pulling tighter around me in the wind, a seagull fed on tiny morsels of something on the trashy asphalt, 100 miles from the ocean. 2 miles away, my wife was packing to leave me. I left my car in the lot and walked into a neighborhood among sparrows plunging their heads into the blades of grass. Even the house cats, stretching and licking on windowsills, had something definite on their minds for later, pausing mid-lick in case it might be me, now. But today, I'll stay home, making do with what I have. Outside, everything is leaning into one decision after another. A freight train slows down to cross my street, one hand emerging as if to wave from the long window of a boxcar. In here, the fridge is busy saving what is left of what is left. The TV is a voiceless flickering in the corner of my eye. Weeks ago, I wrote the checks for this brief future. Today, I lie down on the lawn. I will not bother to mow again.
That was Laid Off from Jim Peterson's newest book, The Horse Who Bears Me Away. Let's do another one, Jim.
Okay. I'll move further down. This is in the second section called The Fall. I have three sections called The Fall. But it's more about the fall, which you'll see right away. This one is just called Rain. Rain, your voice filters down to me through cottonwood leaves, strokes me into quiet gray light under the window, crawls shaggily into my ear like a late fall fly. You would confine me to the room of my own song, but I will not give you the satisfaction. There is nothing in my hands on the table. I step outside and catch your slang on the brim of my hat. Your words have taught me to search for the small, dry underside of an alder leaf where the wolf spider sleeps. I have learned to follow the syntax of your falling, your parallel structures tumbling over the ground to the place where I belong.
That was Rain by Jim Peterson. Thanks so much, Jim. We have a mutual friend, Eric Campbell.
Yes.
And I asked him, like, what I should ask you about. And one of the things he said was to ask you about the role of ego in for a poet, which is actually strange because it's something that I was just thinking a lot about a couple days ago. Because I was watching, or listening, I should say, on a commute to an old lecture by Anna Freud. And I realized that... I kind of forgotten the real definition of an ego. And, because you think of they have a big ego, they're arrogant and that kind of thing was sort of the colloquial way we use the word. But to psychoanalysis, the ego is there's a metaphor that Freud used and Anna used in this talk of the rider of a horse. And the horse is the id. And the ego is the rider, sort of guiding our internal, our internal drives. We have internal drives. The horse wants to go where it wants to go. And then the rider has to try to turn that into going where the rider wants to go. And that's the role of the ego. So if you have no ego, it doesn't mean that you're, narcissistic or something. It means that you can't control your id is what happens when you have no ego in psychology. And so I was thinking about this in terms of poetry. What do you think of the role of the ego in poetry? Is Eric Campbell asked.
Hey, Eric, if you're here, thank you for this question. Dag nabbit, you've got it. That's a good one there. Let me see if I can answer this. I'm grateful for Eric. He's a really good friend and a really good poet, by the way.
Yeah, he was on, I should mention for everybody, he was on Rattlecast number, like, I don't know, 40 or something back in June. So if anybody wants to go back and check our conversation with him, please do. It's a good one.
The problem with the question, Eric and Tim, is that I don't particularly agree with or follow the Freudian explication of ego and id and all of that. So my wife was a rider, and I watched her ride for many, many years. And there's some element of what you're talking about mm-hmm. there. But what really happens is that the rider has to give up her ego. Yeah. She's got to. If she's too controlling, the horse will always resist. And you're lost. If you go out and watch great riders, good riders, great riders, not so good riders, you'll notice that the ones where the horse's ears are turned back and because the horse is reacting to what the rider is doing, and there's this resistance between the two of them, you see that tension between the rider and the horse, because the ego of the rider is saying, damn it, do what I take, you know, it's like that. So the rider, this is kind of I would say this is more Taoist. And I saw my wife Harriet doing this all the time. It's more like, okay, you go where you want to go, I'll follow. And I'm going to learn how you move. And after a while, she would be so with the horse that then when she asked the horse to go somewhere, the horse was willing. I don't know if that makes sense, but that it was like there wasn't an ego and an id. There was just a connection between the two that was not about fighting. So bad horse people are people who will beat the horse up to get them to do what they want them to do. But then the performance of the horse is always against its will. Whereas a good rider, the horse is doing what it wants to do, not realizing that it's also doing what the rider wants it to do. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
So can we apply this to poetry? Is that the writing process?
Yes. Yes. So if you start writing a poem, and you know what you want it to do right as you're starting, and you, damn it, you're going to make that poem do what you want it to do. If you're working like that, the poem will fight back, or you could say the muse will fight back often. All right. So this was really the point that Dickie got me to when I was describing earlier. He got me listening instead of forcing. You know, I'd get a few words down. Now I'm listening to what could come next instead of already knowing what it damn well had to be next. And so there's that. The ego has to go take a hike. let me mention another friend of mine. I hope she's listening here tonight. Melanie Harris is an old friend and a poet. And we were talking just a few days ago. We were online. We probably weren't talking on the phone, but it was either email or Facebook or something. And this phrase came up from her, what I left in the silent house. I instantly wrote it down. And as we were still corresponding, words started coming to me. I had no, I was not even thinking, they were just coming. And so there was this title, I had it as a title, and now words were falling out of the title down the page. They were coming out organically down the page. And my ego was not there, was not resistant to what was trying to come. So I think that's, that's kind of an ideal situation, but I've courted that. And once I learned that Jim is not smart enough to write a good poem, that this other has to be operating. Once I learned that many, many years ago, everything changed for me. The whole thing changed for me.
So the ego, you know, is just translated as I. So in Freud's actually, you know, in the original, it was the it in the I is what he was talking about when the ego. So who is the I that's writing these poems if it's not Jim? Where do they come from? Like what?
Okay. You're getting into the deep stuff here, man.
Yeah, see, I like the deep stuff. And also, Vicky Miko already said, you said, I don't want to get fancy. And Vicky Miko says, oh, please get fancy. So we have permission to get as fancy as you want.
Okay. All right. So the eye, this has become the truth for me. The eye is only a thought. The eye is what is, in other words, it's what's called the eye thought. If you didn't think you were an eye, you'd be free. But because you think you're an eye, now that eye thought is defending itself and setting itself up, and it becomes this bundle of thoughts or cluster of thoughts in us. And it's all conditioning. The eye is the product of conditioning. Okay? And it's always in a defending or trying to get what it wants, or trying to get pleasure. This is how it works. If you can't, so once I realized that that's all the I was, that there really isn't a substantial I in here, that I kind of saw through what the I structure is. And once that happens, now the things can come from everywhere. They can come from anywhere. Ideas, thoughts, words, they can come from, now I have the universe is sort of my source. Whereas before, it was this little tiny mouse of an eye in me that thought it was a big deal. I mean, it wasn't. Does that make sense? Is that making sense?
No, it definitely does. It's really a topic I'd love to talk about. So the connection between writing and meditation, it's just so strong for me, in my opinion. I think in my life, there are two places where I feel like the no self, like no ton, you know. I feel it when I'm writing like a poem or a story or something where I'm absorbed in it and I no longer am. And the only other place that I feel that way is playing sports. If, you know, I play baseball and, you know, you can, the ball's hit and you like dive and roll and throw it to the first base and you don't even know what just happened. Like it was not you that was moving. And the other time I experienced that is in the process of writing or maybe reading too, when you get absorbed, you're sort of transferring that to another person and letting them get that absorbed in the text, I think maybe. So does writing, is that your kind of meditation, do you think? Is that your practice, would you say?
Okay, again, remember, I'm 72. I there's been a long evolution here. I was for a long time a meditator. I don't meditate any longer. Maybe every once in a while, but not on a consistent basis. Writing is kind of like meditation. I agree with you because you get so focused in a way, and you forget everything else. You forget everything else, and you become very focused. But I would have to say that I have given up the notion of a practice. Because just think of the word. I don't want to be practicing. You know, you can't be practicing to be free of the ego. If you're practicing, that means your ego is in there trying to get free of itself. So I let go of practices, and that felt like a great liberation some years ago when I did that. And it liberated my portrait, my writing even more. So I don't know if I can go further with that or not. I don't know if I'm getting to the question you were asking.
No, I think you definitely did. And I don't want to talk too much without getting through more poems. So let's read maybe, let me look at your list right quick. Let's do Tundra and the Mole, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay. Tundra is another Montana poem, and I think it will speak for itself. Tundra. For more than 1 year, I have wanted to talk to a crow. Coming down the Beartooth Pass today, I spotted a giant one, a raven maybe, ranting on the dead limb of a tree on the low side of the road. No one was in my rearview mirror, so I stopped and rolled down my window. With each embellishment, He dipped his head and lurched, the whole tree twisting in a mad loop. He spoke to someone on the high side, above my head, out of sight, and ignored me. "What are you doing?" I said. He stopped his exclaiming to look at me. "What are you doing? What are you doing?" I was in a great mood from hiking 15 miles of bare-toothed tundra. I never thought he would look at me, but he did. For 5 seconds, maybe six. His eyes, black beetles in the sun. He was so black, the light loved him and fell from his back like thrown knives bouncing off a rock. "What are you doing?" I could see in his eyes he knew who I was exactly. "Stupid human," he said, then lifted from that limb like a helicopter from the chaos of a battlefield, filled beyond capacity with the wounded and the dead.
It's another great poem. That was Tundra from Jim Peterson's newest book. And I just got to tell you, Jim, I sort of flipped through on Sunday reading some of these poems, and I happened to read that one. And then later I played tennis with some friends, and a crow landed on the fence right next to our tennis match and watched us play tennis for like 5 minutes. Every once in a while I would like caw or something. So I had a very weird, surreal moment thinking about this poem. And then you sent it, you know, in the email this morning, you said you're going to read it. And I thought, God, that is some weird stuff going on there.
I have a lot of weird things going on with animals in my life. I love the animal world.
Say more about that. Like, what is it about the animal world that that you're drawn to or is drawn to you, you think?
Well, I think part of it is that the animal, this is something I believe, I guess I can't say with 100% certainty it's true, but the animal is living in there is no real I think. Operating in the animal is just going to what's next and enjoying and hoping to be able to eat and then play and run and catch something. Or it's just such a full, vigorous kind of involvement in its own in its life that I love. I love going out with my dog and just watching her chase a squirrel. That's the most. That to me is so much fun. I just laugh so. It's just like, because she can't catch them. And then they'll go up halfway up the tree and kind of make fun of her, you know, from up on the tree because she can't get to them. But just watching all of that joyous activity. Now, I know it's more serious than that and that they do catch them and they do eat them and all of that is going on. But I don't think in their world there's nothing wrong or bad with that. That's just life, you know. I don't know. Anyway, I know that I'm an animal. I have no doubt of that. I am a biological robot, essentially, unless I do realize that thing about the eye that I was talking about before. I think when a person really sees through the eye thought and realizes that there really is no eye doing anything, it thinks it's doing everything, but the world will teach it over and over again that it can't do anything. When there's a realization of that, that just kind of fades. It's still there. It can function, but it's not running the show. And we become more of a real animal, I guess. In Buddhism, they call it the original face. You know, who is your mother and father? What is your original face before your mother and father were born? That's the koan. I have a book titled Original Face. Because in that book, the whole point of the whole book is trying to get past the duality of I and other into that original innocent beingness that we are.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, I always wonder, I mean, we're talking really about sort of the, you know, Adam and Eve before the fall or something, you know, before the knowledge of good and evil and before the worry about our fate and stuff. Do you think that we as human beings who know of our own mortality, which is what it's really all about, Have we gained something even as we've lost that? Like we talk about the, you know, talking about diving for a baseball. That's what my dog does every day. And I only get to do it every once in a while when I, you know, my softball league is not suspended for COVID. Is there something we gain by being able to examine life or sort of, do you wish that you were a dog?
No, I don't wish I was a dog. And, you know, I think way back, was it Socrates or Plato who said, know thyself? Who was it that originally said that? Was it
I'm
Plato?
Not sure.
Okay, know thyself. I don't think for a long time we really knew what he was talking about. Because knowing, a dog can't know herself. It doesn't need to. But a human being, we generate this phony self in here. And now we've got to know it, because if we don't, we can't get. So what happens is we start out as an infant. We're basically like a dog. We're innocent in that way. All this stuff gets put upon us, all this conditioning. And then at some point we start waking up and realizing what's happened. And we start seeing through that. And then it's possible to pass into a phase beyond that. But it's a very powerful and potent phase. Because we have gone through that, because we fall into believing that we are this I, and we go through that for a while. Then when we come out of that on the other side, now we're more whole and complete for knowing that. It's like, and also that then can become a tool rather than being the boss of us. It's an instrument that we can use.
Yeah.
So I think, no, I'm glad I'm a human being. I'm very glad I'm a human being.
Yeah, yeah, like the Buddha who, you know, finds nirvana and then decides to come back to use, you know, that knowledge as a tool for everybody else. Yeah. Let's do another animal poem then. The mole is another fitting poem to come up next.
Okay. Another animal human poem.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Human animal poem. But remember, we're still in the fall of this book. So this is another fallen character here. Like all of us. The mole. I am the fox that listens to the mole. Or the mole, something in me says, that reveals its ancient goal. I wish I could say I have let go of the whiskey, the pot, the bad politics, my dream of a loving and available God. How can I convince myself of my own worth, standing knee-deep in the creek like all the other stones, or lying back in the driver's seat in an empty parking lot, watching the weather through carved glass. I still look for the light in myself and others, the gang of boys cruising on their skateboards, the homeless old dog scavenging the cracks and curbs, trying to remember that warm corner where he curled up last night. I feel for the pistol my father left me 35 years ago, unfired in all that time, the ammo almost as old as I. If that man creeping around the closed grocery store approaches me, I'll just give him what I have. A few bucks, my old pair of boots still waterproofed. But nobody heads in my direction. Maybe we all understand each other. Or maybe I'm scary as hell, a tuft of my hair visible in the half-lowered window. Maybe they can sense that 38 curled up like a small, cold cat in my coat pocket. I hope not. I don't mean to have it. I just do. I've decided I don't need to understand anything. I'll just lie back in the creek and allow the water to flow over me. I was falling asleep anyway, not waking up as I had hoped. I've decided to be the contented mole, traveling underground, pushing up circuitous mounds to draw the hungry fox. To be this old man, half asleep, half awake, sitting in his beat-up car, the given, swirling around me like the glints of light on a summer lake. The all-consuming, unimportant journey still coursing through me like the dream I almost forgot, but didn't.
Excellent. That was a perfect timing for that poem, too. That was The Mole from Jim Peterson's book, The Horse Who Bears Me Away. Jim, the next poem you wanted to read is Masks. And it's a prose poem. And I wanted to ask a little bit about that, because every time we publish a prose poem, people write in and say, why is this, like, that's good writing, but why is this a poem? And and my if I'm feeling glib, my answer is because we're a poetry magazine and a poet sent it to us and called it a poem, and we liked it. But if not, there's something that makes a poem different from prose in a way. Like what is it to you? Like, I have my own opinion, but I'm curious what you think makes these, because the book, if you look at the front of the book, right? I'll put it on screen for everybody. In the front of the book says, "The Horse Who Bears Me Away, Poems, Jim Peterson." And then there's a section with, I think, four prose poems. So
five
prose poems. So what makes those poems still, even though they're prose?
Well, you're calling them prose poems.
Okay. What are you calling them?
I don't know that I call them anything. I guess they are kind of poetic, but they're not cadenced in the way that poems are. They don't. I'm not using the ends of lines to create any kind of effects. You know, the margins on the right are ragged. Mark Cole, who designed the book for Red Hen, he originally had them, the margin, what would be the right word, just flush. And I asked him to let it be ragged, because I really like the ragged edge. Because I don't like it to be a block. I think the eye likes that ragged edge better. But there's everything's by accident at the ends of the lines. It's just whatever word just happens to land there and so on. So I really am not sure I can answer your question.
Well, maybe not for these.
I do write fiction. This sort of is a trend. These are sort of transitional things into my fiction writing to a degree. Go ahead.
Well, just in general, I just wanted to use that as a step off, though. Like, what is a poem, though? What makes it a poem as opposed to prose? You know? Like, what's the difference? Like, where, you know, you write some books that are novels, right? And you write some books that are books of poetry. There must be a difference, right? We have different words for them. So what's the difference?
Yeah. You, this is a tough question, I think. And I've heard all kinds of answers. I think for me that the measurement of the line is what makes the biggest difference. I mean, there's a poet, James Tate, and there was a certain point in his career, and he'd been a poet, you know, and his lines were, the line was important, and how he broke the line. All of that was a big part of what he was doing. And then as he got older, he said, to hell with all that. And he started writing these poems that really are, they just flow across the edge of the end of the line. They don't. And then the more he did this, he wrote four or five of these books at the end of his life, and they became what he cared about more than the other, I think. And they become really whimsical narratives, and I love them. I really like them better than the poetry. And I think writers like Tate, he calls them poems. They're on the front of the cover, it's called poems, but these are not poems, I can assure you. But that's what he was known for, so they call them poems. But you look at them, and you'll agree, I think, that they're not really poems. But there's still something important.
Yeah, I think they're his best poems. You know, they're my favorite of his. I'll just run by. I don't think we've discussed it on the show, like my opinion of what the difference is. But I feel like prose is trying to sort of work on the mind's eye, is the central like place that it lives. So you're sort of visualizing and you're moving ideas around in this sort of this space that's almost like a movie or something. Whereas poetry exists in like the heart or something. It's in the body or the regulation of your breath, which you talked about the length of lines being important. I think that's because the length of the line is sort of the length of an articulation of speech or something. And so right. Poetry is sort of like of the body, and prose is of the mind. That's the distinction that I always get. And then so certain poets like James Tate sort of walk the boundary between the two and sort of play with that in an interesting way, where they're still sort of living in the body, but they're sort of creeping up against that mind's eye kind of target, you know? Does that make sense, or is that just my own crazy theory?
That's interesting. I'm having to consider it. Well, if when I read this, I don't think that you're going to say this is of the mind.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why I'm calling it.
It might say it's of the heart, but it's prose.
Yeah, which is why I still call it poetry. But we'll see. But you're the poet, so you can call it, you know, it's up to you what to call it, I guess.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I don't know. I just know that Red Hen over the years has become more and more open to a kind of hybrid texts. And they encourage people to have both poetry and prose in there. And I just happen to have these, and I love them, so I enjoy reading them.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to hear the masks?
Yeah, let's hear masks.
Masks, okay. Buckle your chin straps. Masks. Oh, I have to give you one note. Part two is based on an experience in Peru with a Peruvian ayahuasquero or shaman. Masks, part one. The skin of my face takes the shape of each outward attitude I need. Like the one for her after I ran away because I was scared of a strange man on our street, and she found me huddled in the woods and pressed her hand on my chest to feel the rattling of my heart. Like the one for him when I came home when I wanted to, which was way late, his hand unbuckling the belt and whipping it from around his waist, throwing out and uncoiling that black circle of himself until the backs of my legs gave up every last hope of ever sleeping and forgetting. Like the one for those who gave me a place in the crowd at school to hide when I didn't know who I was or what I was or where I might possibly go. Like the one for her whose eyes shone through her mask to something in me that she saw and liked that I didn't know was there, but now I do. Like the one for the sky with white clouds passing over, black clouds passing, clear sky full of the mask of the sun, pretending to be nothing and everything at once. Like the one for catching rain and letting it in, the one for making a speech, the one for shaking hands. Like the face designed to fit snugly in the palms of my hands when I need to hold it, to feel its exterior separateness, to feel through it inwardly toward a position that witnesses all of my masks and looks out through their eye holes, seeing that deep witness in others that lives and understands from a place beyond the need for masks. Two. What means to you a mask? The shaman asks, sitting on the floor cross-legged behind a small altar holding stones and feathers. I make them from money, she says. I create them to stay alive, to hold my dream faces in my hands, my powerful faces that cause the world to give and take. He says, that's interesting. She says, I make them to sell in gift shops and galleries, all of my faces going out into the world and possessing the others, covering them, mastering them, becoming them, until I can take my mask off and lay it in the grass and walk away like it's just another leaf that let go, blowing in the wind, flying over the shoes of strangers, disappearing in the woods where the deer curl up and sleep at night. He says, I understand. He begins to rattle and sing, calling to the beings of light, the spirits of the sacred mountains, the condor and the puma, the being of the plant medicine that pulses green and shining in his veins. She falls as if something is guiding her down, her body collapsing like a segmented tent pole, but stretching out again on the floor. The shaman goes to her, strokes the long condor feather over her again and again, flicking the tip as it passes over her feet. He keeps singing and shaking his rattle, and her body stretches and stretches and flows like the part of a river seen through a gap in the leaves. She is the river of masks. She is the mask of the one river always changing.
See, I think that is a poem. I just, everybody at home, can't you feel, I wonder, maybe we could take a poll or something, but don't you feel like there's the way that your own heartbeat, as you're listening to that, sort of starts to match with the rhythms of the poem. Like, there's something bodily about that, that it's like the difference between, like, watching a film at a movie theater versus watching a concert. Like, there's a beat, you know, and your heart starts to be regulated by that.
I'm getting what you're saying now better.
Yeah.
I get what you mean. I call it rhetorical because they're repetitive devices that I use to create that pulsing rhythm. And you're right. That is of the body. I have to agree.
Yeah, I think that's what poetry is. And then also, like, when you, even if you're reading yourself, if you're sub-vocalizing words and reading yourself, you still have the neurons stimulated for the muscles that form the words. Like, the when a poet writes a poem, they're using your body as the medium. Like, I can feel when you read that poem, like, my body becoming the medium. And when I'm reading or hearing a novelist read from a novel, I feel like there's a movie going on, and it's sort of, I'm watching it and sort of in it.
Yeah.
But I'm not like, it's not like beating on me in the same way. So that's a distinction to me. And
you made it really clear there. I agree with you. That's a good, a good way to feel it, I think.
Okay, good. Well, we're in agreement then. Thanks. So everybody is just, first of all, Melanie is here. She says hi, and she says Maggie the cat's watching too. okay. And so people are just saying how much they love your poems, Jim. I'm not seeing any questions. So if you have any questions, you have one last chance to ask any questions. The other thing Eric Campbell said was that he would like me to be more like the, what's that, the artist studio or the actor studio, that guy who asks, so he wants to know, and I thought this was a good question. See, he should be the host and not me. We should just hire him to be a host. But he wanted to know if there was a writer, living or dead, who you would have dinner with. Who would you want to have dinner with? Any writer, living or dead, and why, of course.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, that's hard. That's another hard one for me. This is a shallow answer, in my opinion. I know there are other answers that would come to me, but a writer that I've greatly enjoyed and who has challenged me a lot is Haruki Murakami.
Oh yeah, that would be that's a great answer, actually. Yeah,
I'm a lover of magical realism and speculative fiction, and I write speculative fiction. And I've got a collection of speculative short stories coming out at the end of next year. But when I had a friend who had just read Kafka on the Shore. It's this big, I'm telling you, man, you better be ready. You better talk about buckling your chin straps if you're going to read that. It's like there are times you have no idea where you are in that thing. And then all of a sudden a piece lands and it's like a lightning bolt of connection all the way through, and you go, oh, and you see it. And there's a lot of craziness in there, and there's some graphic violence, and there's stuff that some people, and graphic sex too. Murakami loves to write very graphically about sex. But it's just the whole thing, just the bigness of that vision that he has in some of those novels. The Wind Up Bird Chronicle is, I think, I don't know, I'm just astonished at that book and how mesmerized I was for 500 or 600 pages, however long that thing is, just totally, absolutely mesmerized. So he might be somebody I'd love to sit down and talk to. He is kind of a metaphysician, and there's a metaphysical thing going on in all of his books. And he's about, he tends to split this world of reality that we commonly live in, and with there's some other hidden domain, hidden world, that his characters somehow get connected to, get caught up in. And now they're trying to figure out either how to come back to the ordinary world, or they're learning how to operate in that other world. But it has a lot of meaning up for us. It's like science fiction in a way. The best science fiction is, I mean, I think of, The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin. You know, all of the significance that book has to us human beings on planet Earth, but none of the story occurs here, you know. So anyway, he would certainly be one I would like to pick. I'd like to pick his brain and know what the hell he's trying to do in some of those. He's also written some magnificent short stories, too.
Yeah, he has. He might be my favorite prose author, speaking of prose. I love everything I've read of his. And he'd be a great dinner guest, because, you know, the depth of knowledge and the strangeness of the way he thinks is both really interesting, for sure. That's a good answer. And I wouldn't have thought of that either. I wanted to ask a follow-up earlier, and sort of didn't get to it, but you mentioned that, I think it was Melanie's prompt. Am I remembering that right? You mentioned how the poem just started like flowing down from that title kind of. And how does the writing process work for you, and how do you know when a poem is done? Like, do you I understand that there's like some inspiration that sort of triggers you into propelling, you know, being propelled forward into a poem, right? But what is the process like after that? Like, how many drafts do you go through? Is it someone mentioned earlier automatic writing, and you know, a lot of those things we're talking to sort of relates in that way, but I assume you do revise and things like that. So what does your writing process actually look like at a pragmatic kind of level?
Well, I don't do automatic writing anymore, but I'm grateful for those 2 or 3 years where I did it avidly, would write as fast as I could. The muscles in my hand became, had big muscles in my, because I would start no punctuation, write as fast as I could for as long as I could. And just fill pages. And then I'd go back a week later and look in that notebook, and I would have no idea who had written any of it. But there would be these passages that were better than anything I had ever written when I was trying to write a poem. And it just kept dawning on me. You know? Everybody's got to find their own way. But I had to get out of Jim. I had to get out of the self to a degree, or get into some other more unconscious part of that, to find my voice as a writer. Connect me back up now, Tim, to where
well, we were talking about, I got, since you have that sense of like getting out of your own way, right? It makes me sort of imagine that you don't revise much, but I assume that you do. So that's kind of the question.
No, I do. If I could share the screen and just show you a folder of one of my poems. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be 30 or 40 drafts easily of most of my poems. Occasionally, I'll write a poem that I'm going, oh, man, I'm going to come back and look at it many times, but I don't know. I think this is it. You know, it happens right in the first draft. It does happen occasionally. But usually, for one thing, after I finish the first draft, more stuff keeps coming for that poem. And then I have to go, man, the poem would be even better if it had that in it. I got to get more, so some of the revision is like that. And then some of it is that there is chaff in that process. It's wheat and chaff, and you have to separate the chaff from the wheat. You just have to get the extraneous bullshit stuff that comes through. You have to get some of that a lot. You got to get it all out if you can. And I don't always get it all out. You know, some of my poems are flawed in that way, some of that stuff, but I work so hard to get it out. So I actually do revise. But here's a statement that I make, and I believe it, that revision is writing. Really, if I sit down to revise, okay, here's a poem, I'm working on it, I've got a couple of drafts, I'm going to sit down and look at that poem again. Something comes to me, just in the same way it did in the original draft writing. When I'm revising, it's coming to me in that same way if I'm open. And so to me, revising and writing the original is really the same process. I don't feel like they're wholly different.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I assumed, and a good explanation of it, and good advice too for everybody. Thanks, Jim. We're kind of over time, but do you want to finish on one last poem or whatever you want? One of the longer ones is fine too, or... whichever one you feel like closing up on, because
is Eternal House too long? That's about a 4-minute read.
That'd be great. Yeah, let's do it.
Are you sure?
No, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, it's not like there's an actual time limit. We just try to keep these sort of a relatively consistent length. So
this is the I thought of it as the last poem in the book, but then there is a prologue. There is a epilogue. But I won't read the epilogue tonight. But I think I like this poem. This is a poem that I have maybe 100 drafts of, trying to get the rephrasing and everything on it. So I hope it works. It was published in the South Dakota Review, and a magazine that I like a lot, and I love the editor up there, Leanne Rorapaw. This is called Eternal House. Oak leaves blow over the wide porch. Windows stained by storms reflect the low autumn sun. Doors older than empires swing open. Children scatter like cockroaches, turn and rise up on their hind legs when cornered, then shout as they run into the garden. A woman carries a tray of bread and wine into the crowded dining room. All the names carved into the long table, some long buried and lost under the names of others. Mice skulk under the polished floors. The bones of saints and murderers breathe all night within the foundation. Interior walls morphing from stone to mud to brick to board. The heads of beasts hang in a lighted hall beside diplomas and awards. Books lounge on the shelves, hiding caches of the long dead between the walls. Diamonds, manuscripts, diaries, loaded guns, rolls of cash, bloodied knives. The widow's small room collects statuettes and candles. An old dog curls up against the crack of light, noticing through its lids the late night shadows of feet passing by. In the kitchen cupboard, bags of flour and sugar and salt stand at attention in their long rows. In halls and bedrooms, closets harbor abandoned staffs and clubs. Dresses cascade into the rubble of footwear. Ties lap up the darkness of overcoats and scarves. Tickets to an old drama on the honor of a daughter and her father the king nestle in the breast pocket of a jacket. Belts curl up like the rings of a bristlecone pine. This is where I live. The past grins at me from mantles. The dark bruise of the cellar lie in wait, still as the minds of sages. Chameleons sprawl on window screens like notes pinned to the lapels of lost children. The glassed-in back porch embraces the best winter sun reserved for heads of the household. I could take up hammer and saw, apprentice myself to carpenters and architects. Build more rooms of mud and stick and brick and stone and board and glass and steel. I could take up the sword, the gun, the hand grenade, and defend the boundaries of the estate. I could cook and serve meals. I could sit back in the drawing room, prop my heels up on good leather, smoke a cigar. I could gather round the kitchen table and sing. I could start an argument or press my ear against the door and dream the right weapon in my hand. I could bear the new child in my womb, bring her forth in white sheets. Could withdraw from the pale husk of my body in that same bed with the hand of that child on my face, her eyes beseeching me to stay. I could stop everything, stand in the middle of this empty, ancient house, listening to the creaking of floorboards, the rattle of windows in the wind, the satisfying rub of tongue within groove. I could walk out to the front field with the great tarantula of the sky turning over my head. A moment so naked and so long, the house disappears. Its elements flying out into the bodies of trees, the tall wild grass, the deer and the fox and the beetle. I gaze out into the world from the porch of my own brow, this house of my own making and my undoing.
Excellent poem to end on. Thanks so much, Jim Peterson. That was Eternal House from Jim Peterson's newest book from Red Hen Press, The Horse Who Bears Me Away. Jim, thanks so much for being a guest today. I'm really glad that we sort of got connected and get to share your poems in this wonderful book, which I really love. Thanks for being a guest tonight.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. Thank you, Eric, for your questions. and Melanie and Patricia and all my friends, Tatum and Makla probably, and a lot of Jennifer, a lot of my friends I think are probably here. I appreciate, I'm forgetting some of the names, but thank you all for coming. And thank all the rest of you too out there.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, Jim. Have a great rest of your night.
I will. Bye. You too. Bye now.
So that was Jim Peterson with his newest book, which I'll put on the screen one last time. This is The Horse Who Bears Me Away from Red Hen Press. Just a wonderful poet, a wonderful book. I really enjoyed this book. read the whole way through. You can find it at redhen.org. Just type in Jim Peterson or look for their most recent books that came out, because this is one of those, The Horse Who Bears Me Away by Jim Peterson, with that beautiful horse, which you saw in the background of his video there. It's a gorgeous cover, and that black eye of oblivion staring at us. Thanks so much, Jim, for being a guest today. Now, the end of the show is always a open mic for a prompt. And the prompt for this week was, let me pull it up for everybody. The prompt was, so the prompt for this week was, what's on the other side of that door? Now, if you wrote a poem for the prompt this week, please feel free to call in and share it. The number we have is 818-850-7727. That's our open mic line. Let it ring a few times. When you call, it'll appear on my call screen, and then I will call you back when the time is right. The other option is to use Skype. Don't bother with both. Just use one or the other. Send me a chat message over Skype at Rattle Poetry, and the same thing will happen. Just like wave to me, you know, and I will accept your whatever they call it. Accept your connection. I think they call it connection on Skype. And then I will call you when the time is right. So just let me know you want to be here, like Carla Schwartz is right now on the phone. I'm not going to answer, but I will call Carla back later. Do the same thing. So we have Angela Gartner. We have an 805. We have Nivedita Karthik. We have Caitlin Buxbaum, Richard Westheimer, Sally Dunn, Brent Stauffer, Allison Campbell. We got a lot, and the phones are ringing off the hook right now. So looking forward to sharing these poems that that you all wrote this week. So, yeah, so if you want to do that, call in or send me a chat message, like I said. And but before you do, or immediately after you do, email the poem to openmic@rattle.com, all one word, openmic, openmic@rattle.com. Then we can show the poem as you read. So that's how this is going to work. Now, my poem for this week, I didn't give myself enough time, which I'd have to stop doing. So I wanted this to be a sonnet, and I kind of ran out of time. So it's sort of a nonnet or I don't know what. It's only eight lines. I only got eight lines through. But this was my The Other Side of the Door poem. Here it goes. On the other side of the door is nothingness. Don't worry yourself with that. This world has rooms enough for all your dreams, a wife, a house, some kids, a dog, two cats. And think of all the other doors that seem to lead somewhere, but don't. There's nothing more outside of what you've always known. Ignore the single door. Don't touch its silver knob. Keep shut the latch like it's your only job. So that is my, I think if you come back in a little bit, maybe if you are friends with me on Facebook, maybe I'll post the actual on Facebook. That is eight lines of a eventual sonnet. I got to get some images in there, but I couldn't really see the room is the problem. But Megan had a good poem here. This is On the Other Side of the Door, same title. And this is Megan's prompt poem. And of course, her prompt. She's the one who makes these prompts up every week. Here's Megan's prompt poem. On the other side of the door, your baby blanket, soft as you recall, your mother's recipe in her tidy scrawl, the entire month you missed when you were sick, your lost silver button, your neon lipstick, the day you said no, untouched and new, two futures, one with and without you, your dad's cigar butts, your sister's perfume, the broken floorboard of your childhood bedroom, your dead dog still a pup, your legs at 21, that burger from the diner in Maine, well done, the letter she wrote you, she never sent it. The car of your dreams, slightly dented. That was Megan's poem, On the Other Side of the Door. Now, let's see what you have tonight. Caitlin Buxbaum, I'll find. So what do you have for us today?
So I was really glad that you put this prompt out there, because I've been meaning to do a sort of ekphrastic series on a bunch of pictures of doors posted by a poet. So there's a poet, I don't know if you know him, named Adam Clay, who had a book called To Make Room for the Sea come out this year. And I just thought the cover was beautiful. I still haven't even read the book, but I followed him on Instagram and he posts all these random pictures of doors. So I was like, oh, perfect. And I didn't write on the one that I was planning to, but it's still a good one. So
yeah, this is a cool door for sure. You included a picture so we can all see. So here it is, and there's no sound in the background. I am sorry about that. Okay, so this is Bywater by Caitlin Buxbaum. Go ahead whenever you're ready, Caitlin.
Okay, I will say Bywater, part of the reason I titled it that is because that's the location stamp that was on this photo. I don't know what state it's in, but yeah, so anyway, this is Bywater. What comic's gift can shine without his sapphire sorrow? Which poet fails in writing to melt her buttered walls in favor of art sliced raw? Climb the stairs, cross the porch adorned with tired September plants. The only way to catch a glimpse of truth through windowed words is to brave the details of your own reflection. How many have grasped the algae pool edge there and never chanced a dive? Enter if you dare. Behind that heavy door may be a home for you, and other tenants too. Dwell in depth as long as lungs allow, but don't forget to venture back into the autumn light and breathe the present air.
Excellent. Thanks so much for sharing that, Caitlin. That was Bywater by Caitlin Buxbaum. Another excellent poem, and that's a cool picture too. Thanks for sharing that, Caitlin.
Thanks. Oh, I forgot to mention, you got a shout out on Billy Collins' broadcast today.
Oh, really?
He had just discovered Tom C. Hunley and was like, oh, I love this guy's poems. And also he was published in Rattle, and Rattle's pretty great.
Oh, that's
so
cool. I have to go back and look at that. And I, you know, I we should have Billy on as a guest. I asked him if he would do something. Oh, years ago, I asked him if he would do transatlantic poetry with us. And he said he was not good enough with computers. But now that he's doing Facebook Live, like 5 years later or something,
oh, yeah,
I think he might be. So maybe I should ask him to be on an episode.
Totally.
Oh, cool. Thanks for letting me know that, Angela. I mean, Caitlin.
Whoever I am, we're all the same.
Yeah.
It's all good.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks, Caitlin.
Yeah.
Yep.
See
bye.
Ya.
Okay. Let's see. Let's call up next. Let's call up Brent is next. Hey, Brent. How you doing tonight? I'm not hearing you. You're very, very, very quiet.
How's that?
It's good. You're good now.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's the, you know how this thing is, this particular iPad of mine, it somehow it manages to perform the same operation in different ways.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's the magic of modern technology, I think. But yeah, I think it just needs to buffer or something. Like it sort of like takes a while to connect. Let me try to find Brent.
Yeah,
oh, here it is.
Okay.
Yeah, so what did you have for us today?
Okay, well, like you, I didn't give myself enough time. I imagined that I would talk about the door for a bit and then move on to contemplations of what was beyond the door. But I only got as far as contemplating the door. And I think that this might actually be the end of the poem, because I like the idea of somebody getting so wrapped up in the door that they forget about going through it, seeing what's on the other
yeah,
side.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I meant to go into like the whole what was going on in the room, and I never got there. But okay. So what's behind it was your poem.
Yeah, I stayed there. Okay. What's behind it? The door, a jubilant red, remains closed, or it's the color of freshly spilled blood. The thousand doors in this house are all shut tight like the surface of a straining eardrum. This crimson, though, is a rose of Lancaster, or it's a welcome beacon for wary wayfarers. Should we open it? What do you think? It's so red. Maybe that means something. Is it locked, or when it's swung open with a sigh? Outside the house begins the slow rush of night. Yellow sunlight squeezes through dim windows to lay across the egg white walls in golden bars. Watch ourselves consider our own warped figures in the bright brass doorknob as in a convex mirror.
Excellent. And that was Brent Stuffer's poem, What's Behind It. I think that works. Yeah. I like it. I like it, Brent. I think it's done. That's where you wanted to go with
okay.
it. Yeah.
Well, good. Yay. That's great news.
Cool. Thanks, Brent. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Okay. Let's call up Allison Campbell. I don't know if Allison Campbell's been on before. Let me see. Let's call up Allison. And hey, Allison, can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi, I can hear you. Yeah.
Excellent. I can't see. If you want to click on the camera, you can come in. But we have audio, so if you don't, that's fine too.
Yeah. Okay. Do you want me to read the poem?
Yeah. So, what poem do you have? Because I was this the random street view? Because I think that's all I have.
Yeah. It's a random street view of Ireland.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. That was last week, but that's okay. Let's just get it in here. This is an unnamed road. This was last week's prompt. The random street. You take a picture from randomstreetview.com and write a poem
that's
about
right.
that. And so yours is an unnamed road in County Westmeath, Ireland.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
And are you calling from Ireland?
No. I'm coming from the UK. London.
Okay.
Yeah. But I've been to Ireland, but not that part. No.
Okay. Is there anything you want to say about this before you read it, or do you want to just jump right in?
Well, I just saw I subscribed to Rattle, and I just saw the trigger thing, and I thought, oh god, that sounds great. I'd never seen Random Street View. And I just went onto it, and it's this beautiful road in Ireland. So it just kind of sparked a poem.
Oh, very cool. Okay, well, let's hear it.
Okay, it's called Unnamed Road, County Westmeath, Ireland. I reach back, grab the AA road map from the back seat, say to one of the children, in God's name, find where we are. The road's unmarked. We've no idea. It's a road to nowhere. I turn the car back into a hedge, screech off to find a turn. Now lilac trees shed petals, cover an unnamed road leading to somewhere in County Westmeath. There's a weave of clouds, shapes of smoky purple, sunlight on the single track, clumps of blossom just holding. And I'm wishing I'd been there years ago. This time, I'd park the car up that grassy bank, lean on the bonnet, breathe the cool air. I'd turn my head, call back to the children, come out, will you? And just take a look at this road leading to God knows where.
Excellent. I love that ending. Thanks so much. And that was Allison Campbell with Unnamed Road, County Westmeath, Ireland. Thanks so much for calling in, Allison. I hope you can do it again.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
Yeah, bye. Yeah, it must be very late in the UK. Allison sent that poem right after the show last week. So I hope that we missed it. It was just a few hours later. So I thought maybe might as well get that in. Let's see. Let me just really quick, because I think Vicky has connection trouble sometimes. Let me read Vicky Miko's poem really quick. This is Your Mind, the Swinging Door. It's pretty short, so I'll just read this for Vicky here. Your mind, the swinging door. You're the aperture of your mind. You're the mind itself begging to be. You're the other side of someplace else. You'll always come back the way you came, but you'll never come back the same. Excellent little poem there from Vicky Miko. Thanks for sharing that, Vicky. Let's call up. I don't know if we're gonna be able to get to everybody. Who is this? This is let's see. You know, maybe we'll do. Yeah, I don't know if we're gonna be able to get to everybody this week. I'm sorry to everybody. Let's see. Next up though would be Carla Schwartz. Let's call up Carla. Phone is ringing, and I will find Carla's poem.
Hi, hang on. Okay, it's me.
Hey,
Carla.
Yeah, hey, Carla. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good. It's a great night of poetry.
Yeah, I love Jim William or Jim Peterson. He was really fun to talk to.
What
was
yeah.
your... What was your poem about?
My poem?
Yeah. What was it
about? My poem. So it's called Dystopian Hotel, and I didn't think I'd be able to write an Other Side of the Door poem. And then suddenly it came to me, actually, I think either yesterday. But I had a dream. And there was a door in my dream, and I wrote about it. And so that's, I'll read you the poem if you want.
Okay, great. Dystopian Hotel. This is Carla Schwartz. Go ahead, Carla.
Yep. The next place I go is a hotel with a swimming pool where the parking lot would be. This is not a time of masks. Many people walk around. I find my room behind the pool. When I open the door, I see the room is no bigger than a closet. It might once have been a maintenance closet with a mop-up sink. Oh, you know what? I have the wrong one, so I'm going to read it from yours. This is not a time of mess. Many people walk around. I find my room behind the pool. When I open the door, I see the room is no bigger than a closet. It might once have been a maintenance closet with a mop-up sink. Now squeezed in behind a small basin and toilet, a tiny mattress. There are no windows. Rest seems impossible. Restlessness inevitable. Is this a future we can all look forward to?
Thanks, Carla. That was Dystopian Hotel. Kind of a, one of those 2020 in a nutshell type visions of a metaphor of a poem. Thanks for sharing that, Carla.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Tim, for everything.
Yeah, my pleasure. Bye-bye. Good night. Okay. Let's see. You know, maybe we'll just try to get to everybody on the list because we had those two, Angela and Nivy. I messed up their recordings. Now we're calling up Joy Stahl. And I will find Joy's poem. Door number two.
Hello.
Hey, Joy. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I am so tired.
Is it a late one?
No, I'm just exhausted from working both of my two jobs today.
Oh, wow.
I teach during the day and in the evening as well, two nights a week.
Where is it that you work? What do you do?
Well, I teach middle school, and then I also teach English as a second language to adults in the evening.
Oh, how is that going? Are you doing it online or is it in person?
Well, we've kind of been bouncing back and forth. And tonight was the first night that I could have had the adults back in the building, and I only had one person show up. So it was kind of anticlimax, but we'll get them back in. We got the middle schoolers back yesterday. So
I'm trying to find it. Hang on a second. Let me see.
I sent it right at the end of the...
Is this it? Here it is. Okay, I've got it now. This is it. Door number two. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
All right. I will say that I failed at writing this until I took a comic view of it.
Okay.
Door number two. Costumed and prepared with a purse full of minutiae. Eager and breathless. Ready, player one. Showcase time. What is behind that door? A trip? A new car, a living room suite, a beribboned donkey. Let's make a deal.
Thanks. And that was Joy Stahl with a trip down memory lane. I haven't thought of that in quite a while. Thanks, Joy.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good night.
You too.
Okay, let's see. Next up we will do... Carlton asked me to read his poem. This is Beyond the Door. By Carlton Johnson, and I'll just read it for him. Beyond the door. Butterflies ignored in a moment of panic, even when young boys and manic hormones rising get a shot, a lure, indiscretion behind closed doors. Not ever, after the warmth of skin, disgust, his father did not discover, rather nonplussed. Teenage boys will be teenage boys, he intuited something, sapping joy. His eldest son's happiness, and thus killed any desire, going cold turkey. the thrill outspent and faced the start of scores, capers behind closed doors. Excellent. Love the repetition and rhyme in that one. Thanks so much. It was Carlton Johnson with Beyond the Door. Let me call up the next person on the list. Let's see. Have we called? This is the part of the show where it's hard to tell who I've talked to already and who I haven't. This is Sally Dunn. I think we haven't talked to Sally yet.
Hello.
Hey, Sally. How are you doing tonight?
Doing okay.
And your poem is Do Not Open That Door. Is there anything you want to say about it, or are you ready to go?
I'll just say it's still pretty rough. I get the feeling it's trying to go two different directions, and I'm not sure which one.
Interesting. But, well, go where the poem takes you. That's what Jim's advice would be, I think. Do not open the door. Go ahead.
Okay. Do not open that door. The knob is cold. The door sticks. I shove it open with my hip. I tell myself not to, but I have to see. Outside, the world, life. I fall down, roll and slide in mud until covered with slime. Dripping, I stand cold, no sweater, no jacket, no shoes. I peer around. I don't see them, but they were out here once. Well, not here, but that other place I lived, and the place before that. They're dragged behind me, the ghosts, like tin cans tied to my rear. The ones I loved, the ones I never understood, the ones I failed. I grab for the knob. I must get that door closed. If I can pull it shut, if it won't stick, if the lock will hold, I can jump inside. Where serenity is an illusion, I can believe.
Excellent. Thanks so much. And that was Do Not Open That Door by Sally Dunn. Thanks so much for sharing that, Sally. Interesting poem.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, I'll try to move through people pretty quick. Let's see. Let's do Richard Westheimer. So the phone is ringing, and I will find Richard's poem.
Hey, Tim.
Hey, Richard. How are you doing tonight?
Well, it's kind of you to keep pushing through all the long list you have here.
It's all right. You know, I think we probably have to, definitely for the podcast version, we're going to have to cut out the two people that I screwed up for. So we'll keep enough, keep a regular sort of length that way. So what do you have for us? Is there anything you want to say about it before you start? Ars Poetica?
Sure. I'll be real quick. I've used a metaphor that you've used before about what happens when you find a turn in a poem. Mm-hmm. It's like a door in a room that you're kind of in. Only I've thought of it as a box.
And
I'd used the metaphor the other day. And then when you said about doors, I just came to mind. And this sort of feels like poetry is organizing psychosis to me as I read through it. So
interesting.
We'll see what happens here.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing this. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. You got it up?
Yeah.
Okay. Ars Poetica, about me being dropped in a box strewn with words, a pile over here with burr and burrow, and there a shard of broken mirror, and here a hammer and nails, and there a pile of hats, a well run dry, and a sack of cats. By a whispering pine and a thriving hive of rhyme bees, dive bombing, a stack of Bibles and heavy tomes balanced on the beam of a ticking metronome. And overhead, a sky alive with embers strewn with moonlit ash and primal shadows cast on the sides. And with my eyes, I sort and spin into a thread the weft of some new cloth I weave. Burn holes in it with the lit end of a cigarette. Gather the smoke in a net pearled from words I learned from a ghost that guide the gyre lines until I slide into a pile of rose thorns, leap to my feet, and there before me a door come loose from its lintel that stalks me, dreaming, falling, sleeping, awake to that door rehung, swung open, I find at last the ending rhyme.
Excellent. Thanks so much for those. Ars Poetica, about me being by Richard Westheimer, and excellent sounds and rhymes and images in that poem. Thanks for sharing it, Richard. Yeah.
Thanks for the opportunity, Tim. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye. Okay. Let me see who we have left. Did we do? Okay. Here's Brenda Kamarinsky. So the phone is ringing. And this is a short one, so we'll get to it quick if Brenda's there still. It is kind of late, like 15 minutes past the regular shift. Hey, Brenda, how you doing tonight?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So is there anything you want to say about your poem, or sort of in the lightning round, behind the door?
Behind the door, yeah. It's short. We'll be quick.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Behind the door, there are people dancing, filling the streets with music, pouring breath out, and gifting joy to the world. Here on this side, I pour myself into your waiting arms, and you gift your joy to me.
Ah, very sweet little poem. Behind the door. Thanks so much, Brenda. That was great.
Yep. Thanks. Have a good night.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, and then we have Gail Henneman. Let's go do Gail Henneman.
Hello.
Hey, Gail. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing pretty well, Tim. It's a pretty evening out here in Pierce County, Tacoma, Washington area. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Yeah. How's the weather up there in Washington? Has the rain set in where it sort of never stops, or is it a nice night?
Oh gosh, you know, the rain, our trademark rain, is a little drier this year. So we've just got a lot of really clear weather. So we're all kind of in shock a little bit.
Oh, that's nice to hear. I'm glad you're able to enjoy that. So your poem here, Through the Door, it says for Stephen Henn, with a nod to Kim Adenitso. Do you want to explain anything about that, or do you want to just read it?
Sure. Stephen Henn last week, I know he talked about kind of the before and after in his life in poetry, and we've been really fortunate on Rattlecast to hear the way poetry has transformed a lot of people's lives, and he talked about it through the door of sobriety and also how he came to poetry, you know, which was really brave of him. And Kim Adenitso once said that kind of walking, writing about her childhood, she has a line in a sonnet, I'm through the door. So it's kind of all of our past, I guess, that come together when we start to write. I was just thinking about Stephen Henn in the reading last week.
Excellent.
I've been, thank you, Tim. I'm excited to read, and I've been listening to country music, you know, to kind of a new current here during COVID. So singing. So it's been great to listen to folk songs, also some of my family life. Through the door. When you become a little while sober and you see your dreams are getting closer, you may be afraid to walk through the door, although you don't live on this side anymore. The door squeaks behind you now as it closes, leaving old rooms of promises broken. And if you opened up old window shades, you'd see there were shadows in the light's place. So when you turn now and go through the door, the light is bright, but you're on a sturdy floor. Though a strange new light shines in the hallways, it comes from you, so it's a light that stays. The old door is closing, old ways you're leaving. You enter your life and this door is cleaving.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for sharing that. That was once again Gail Henneman with Through the Door for Steve Henn and with Nadia Kim Adenitso. Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you, Tim. Good evening.
Yeah, good night. Okay, so I think we got to everybody. So thanks everybody for your patience and getting through. Let me do one last really quick check. To make sure I had to leave like one person out. Sally, Brenda. Okay. I think we did get everybody. And that's all for the show today. Thanks everybody who called in and shared poems, and thanks for enjoying, as I did, that Jim Peterson interview and all his poems. Of course, his book is The Horse Who Bears Me Away from Red Hen Press. So check that out if you can. And next week's guest on the Rattlecast is going to be, let me tell you about the prompt for next week, of course, first. Next week's prompt is going to be write a poem about a scientific discovery, real or imaginary. That's next week's prompt for the Rattlecast. It'll be Rattlecast number 70. Write a poem about a scientific discovery, real or imaginary. So if you write a poem this week, be sure to share it next on Rattlecast number 70. And next week's guest on the Rattlecast is going to be Alan W. King. His newest book is Point Blank. He's been in two issues of Rattle, and he's a wonderful, wonderful person and another great poet. So we'll get to see a lot of his poetry and talk to him. He also has a really cool video poems that he does. He just released one the other day. I think maybe we'll play that on the show and then talk about it a little bit, because I'm interested in video poetry. It's not something that I feel works really well all that often. And with Alan King, it worked great. So the video poems I've seen of his are really outstanding. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit too. Also his new book, Point Blank. And we'll do, of course, the prompt poem at the end. Write a poem about a scientific discovery, real or imaginary. And that will all be Rattlecast number 70, Tuesday, December 8th, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Hope to see you then. Hope you have a good week. And I will talk to you soon. Good night.